You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 209. I like helping people achieve their dreams, just like people helped me. John Leguizamo.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by screenwriting software Arc Studio. Now, Arc Studio is easy to use, rock solid, and covers the whole flow: structure, writing, rewriting, exchanging notes with partners, and so much more. It's also great for collaboration and writer's rooms. For example, it's been used in the writer's room of Arcane, the hit Netflix show. Now, if you want to check this out for free, all you got to do is go to arcstudiopro.com and sign up. But because you are listening to this episode, you're going to get $30 off all of their paid plans. So check out arcstudiopro.com/bulletproof to see why they are taking Hollywood by storm. That's arcstudiopro.com/bulletproof. Guys, today you are in for a treat. We have the legendary writer, actor, producer, and director, John Leguizamo. And John and I have one of the most candid talks about the film industry, about his journey working with some of the most legendary directors in movie history, and his new project that is premiering at this year's Tribeca Film Festival, The Green Veil, and much, much more. If you guys want to know the inside scoop of what it's like being in Hollywood and working your way up the ladder, then this is the episode for you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Leguizamo. I'd like to welcome to the show, John Leguizamo. How are you doing, John?
Good, good. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, brother. I appreciate it, man. As a fellow Latino filmmaker, you have been an inspiration for many years for me, my friend. So thank you for all the work you've done over the years and all the doors you've opened for all of us, man.
Oh, I you know, it has been easy, but it's been interesting. That's for sure.
The hustle is hard. The hustle is real.
The hustle is real, man. The hustle is no joke. I mean, you gotta hustle. It's so crazy that we're like the largest ethnic group in America, the oldest ethnic group after Native Americans. And, you know, we're all part Native American, at least I am. And just our lack of inclusion is so nutty.
It's pretty insane. But I think things are changing. And I think people like yourself are opening some doors for so many people over the years. Now, first question, man, how and why in God's green earth did you want to get into this insanity called the film industry?
You know, I don't think it's a thing that you wish upon anybody, you know what I mean?
only your enemies, not your friends.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I never knew, you know, I was a naive young man from the hood, and I knew there was no opportunities. So I didn't do it for fame, money, or profit. I just did it because it was the thing that made me feel alive, the thing that made me feel whole, that brought me sanity. You know what I mean? And at 17, I found acting classes, you know, and it was like, oh my God, this is incredible. And I started reading plays, and I was a play reading maniac addict. I read so many plays. And I just found it so beautiful that you could capture human behavior and the human condition in dialogue and have an experience about life and reveal life to other people.
Now, was there a film, a specific film that kind of lit your fuse?
I loved Streetcar Named Desire, you know, that was really powerful to me. That performance was electric. Anything Pacino and De Niro did, you know.
anything Marty did, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much anything Marty did was, you know, like, oh my God, this is like Latin people, you know, like how we behave. And you know, as a Latin person being so invisible, you're always trying to find links to other cultures to feel seen, you know, like for me, Richard Pryor was everything. And,
oh God.
And you know, Scorsese.
I mean, yeah, you look at, I mean, for the longest time, I'm Cuban. So the longest time, the only guy I had was Al Pacino and Scarface. I mean, that was it. And Ricky Ricardo, obviously. Those are, you know, Desi Arnaz. Those are the people I had.
Of course. I mean, Desi Arnaz is a beast.
Oh,
that's
my God.
Crazy thing. I mean, they didn't even show that in that movie that
Sorkin
Desi and Lucy movie. It was like, what? He is the bomb. He invented three-cam comedies. Having a live audience in a sitcom, a residual. I mean, he created all that. And he created Star Trek. You know, he was the one that was a pioneer he was like the first independent studio owner and the first Latin guy to own a studio.
It was insane. But there wasn't a lot of Latinos coming up. That's why when I always say it on the show is the first time I ever saw I could even direct was watching Robert Rodriguez. When I saw Mariachi come out, I was like, oh. So we can do this.
I know. It's crazy. Like, you know, why weren't we allowed? Why weren't we allowed to do this? I mean, it's so crazy. It's like I saw so many talented actors growing up that, you know, unfortunately couldn't. The industry just didn't sustain them, you know, and they had to give up. And it was sad to see all this wasted talent and all these dreams evaporate, you know.
Now, early in your career, you had the pleasure of working with Mr. Brian De Palma on a film called Casualties of War.
Yes.
Man, what was that like? I've heard nothing but epic stories of the insanity on that set and the brilliance of what they were trying to do and Sean and Michael. And like, what was it like being on
that set? Dude, it was crazy. I mean, I know we're here to talk about Greenville.
We'll get to your new film. We're going to go down your road, dude.
Yeah, no, I love Casualties of War. To me, it was such an important film because I don't know, Brian and I and Brian De Palma and I sort of started to get to know each other and trust each other. I think that there has to be a trust between a director and an actor. And therefore, when I got to Carlito's Way, he had this confidence in me and he brought this incredible performance out of me by allowing me to fail on Carlito's Way. Like I did like 30 takes. He wasn't letting anybody do that. He let me do 30 takes on film of just my entrance as Benny Blanco. And he would laugh and I would do crazy. I would knock the waiter's tray off in one take. I would push people out of the way. I flicked my, he loved it. He was, and that love gave me my freedom. That was my freedom. But that was Carlito's Way. Couches of War was just crazy. That was crazy. Like we were, he's a rehearsing kind of director, you know, there are not too many of those. Mm-hmm. And he storyboards everything, bro. He draws it himself. I don't even know how he reads it because I saw those hieroglyphics. I don't know how, but he maps it all out. That's what the genius you're dealing with. And a lot of people got fired, you know, in the rehearsals.
Really?
I don't know if I should say who, but whatever. Sure. A lot of names got fired and other people took their parts and became bigger actors for it. You know, it was difficult, really difficult. And then Sean Penn was, you know, he was our god at that moment, the best actor of the generation. And he was married to Madonna. He left the set. We closed for 3 days while he went to America to see the Sphinx Tyson fight, which lasted 91 seconds.
I remember.
You know, like the shortest fight. I mean, the longest flight for the shortest fight. You know,
can you imagine getting on the plane?
We were in Thailand. That was like a 24, 25, 28-hour flight back. Then another 28 hours back.
Oh, that's insane, man. Was there a filmmaker or actor that you kind of looked up to as you were coming up? Like, you just like, that really inspired you to do what you do?
I looked up at everybody, man.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Everybody was above me. I was down here and everybody was up here and I looked up to everybody, man. I mean, I got to say Richard Pryor to me was a big inspiration. Yes. Lenny Bruce, when I discovered him, Flip Wilson.
Flip, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That dude was, I was going to say that motherfucker was funny, but I think I can't curse, right?
You can curse.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, yeah. That motherfucker was like a big inspiration to me, you know? And then, you know, of course it was, you know, I studied with Lee Strasberg. I studied at HB Studios. Wow. So these teachers, I work with some of the great teachers in American acting, you know, the greatest teachers. And then Win Hammond, you know, who taught Denzel Washington, Alec Baldwin, you know, and then they took me under their wing. And I was a big student. I love learning. It was a place I could act because there wasn't a lot of opportunity for a Latin man. So my opportunities were in acting class. You know, that's where I could do all the big plays and all the big scenes from everything, you know?
Now, there's one part, man, that it's one of my favorite parts you've ever done was Clown from Spawn, dude. That was so hypnotic. I remember sitting in the theater watching that performance, dude, and you couldn't recognize you because you were in that.
No, insane, I wasn't recognizable.
That insane suit. Everyone's afterward like, who was calling? Like, John Leguizamo was it? Holy crap, that was amazing. What did you do to get in the mind of such a psychotic character?
Dude, it wasn't easy. I'm not going to lie. And you know, it's funny you say I was unrecognizable because the whole director was like, no, we're doing it so we can recognize you. So the prosthetics
we're paying
all
for
made
you.
So that
we're
I would look like you. Myself. But yeah, I'm unrecognizable. I mean, I had teeth prosthetics. I had ginormous contacts. Yeah. My whole face was glued with these after a couple of weeks, I had blisters all over my face, pus. My face was raw. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was kind of flim-flamming the director, who was a sweetheart. And he was like, can we just get a taste of what you're going to do? I go, do it. It'll come. When we get on that set and we say action, but I had no idea what was going to come out of me. And I was panicked.
Right.
Panicked, bro. And I took clown lessons. I was doing everything, man, to help me try to
find you didn't know when you accepted the role, you didn't know how you were going to do it. You were just trying to
I knew I was going to say some crazy shit. That sure. I knew I was going to say some crazy stuff and they knew I was going to ad lib and we had, you know, I had prepared them that I was going to ad lib a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So they were cool with that. This what's the voice and how you going to, I had no idea. And then the day, and they kept saying, please give us a taste. I go, dude, you're interfering with my process. But it was like bullshit because I had no idea. And then when they said action, this voice came out, this weird, you know, whatever that, but you know, from that's and then that was it just so came out of panic.
You didn't practice. You didn't practice that prior.
No,
to that?
I didn't know what I was gonna do. I had no idea. I was like,
what?
I don't know.
So yeah. You mean to tell me that you had all the makeup on, you never practiced the word, and you're like, okay, something's gonna just come through me the second they say action.
Well, I was praying. I wasn't really sure that it was gonna
right
put it come through. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I don't believe, but sometimes there's moments where you got to pray.
No, exactly. You just got to like, something has to come through me because
something better come through because these people are spending a lot of money and I'm going to disappoint a lot of people.
I'm all dressed up. I got to get something.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That wasn't like, a small budget.
Going to your wedding and not having made up the mind, your mind in your head that you're going to say yes.
Do you take her? I'm like,
No. I don't know. I had thought about it.
I knew what I was going to say maybe when I got up here.
But now that I'm up here, I don't know. I'm having my doubts.
I mean, so when you approach roles, do you often do that? Or was that specific?
No, never.
That was just that. It was such an insane play, insane role, insane character.
Yeah, never. Like I'm mad rehearsed. I thought so.
Practice, I heard
this. I rehearsed. The more I rehearsed, the better I am. I mean, the role had lived in me for a couple months. You know, I wasn't doing any other job at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was really just living with it subconsciously. And, you know, a lot of actors talk about that. And my teachers say that, you know, sometimes like Meryl Streep will fall asleep with a script and just let her let it take her subconscious. So I was, you know, I do a lot of that too.
Sure.
And I've always done that. It's a strange thing, but you do, you fall asleep and somehow you're in this meditative state and the character starts taking over you. And so, but I was gestating with this character and not wanting to test it, not wanting to try for some weird reason. And then it popped out like that.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. I always love asking.
You know, I've never shared this information with anybody.
So I appreciate. It's an exclusive. I appreciate that. No, I always felt
embarrassed by that.
You're good. You've done okay for yourself, sir. It's okay. You can admit these things now. No, because I always wondered, because I saw that performance. I was like, man, I always thought you didn't get enough credit because that was such a rock star freaking performance, man. And the movie, no blowing smoke up your ass. It was just such a, like, I remember it so vividly. Dude, I haven't seen Spawn since it probably came out. And I still remember the damn performance. And I've seen thousands of movies since. So it stuck with me. So it's just one of those things. It's like, wow, man, I just always wondered how he got in there. Cause, you know, I would ask Joaquin how did he get into the Joker? Like when you get into psychotic
performance, bro.
Oh,
oh my God. That was one of the most beautiful performances. I just got chills talking about that performance. I watched that movie 3 times because I love the movie. I love the script. I love the soundtrack. And he is the motherfucking Mac Daddy, Daddy Mac of all time.
I mean, he's the GOAT. There's no question. No question whatsoever. And I always like asking actors this. What do you look for in a director? Because there's a lot of filmmakers who listen to the show, and I want them to understand what actors are really looking for in a collaborator.
Well, you know, as you get older, I mean, you understand what helps you be your best, right? And helps you. You know, I like a director who lets me feel safe, that I can fail, allows me to fail, allows me to play. And then I'll give you, you know, some horrible shit and some amazing shit. But if you give me the space to fail and let me try and experiment before you start giving me your input and before you start shaping me. Nick Nolte said it so beautifully, and it stuck with me for life. He was with his director, and his director started giving him line readings and telling him how to do it. And he said, my talent is like this feather. He had a feather in his hand. I don't know where he carried it from, whatever. But he said, my talent is like this feather. And when they give me a line reading, this is what happens to my ability. Gone. And I was like, yeah, that's what happens. If a director steps in too early and you're experimenting, all you can hear is their choices. You can no longer hear your own impulses or your own intuition. You can't hear it anymore. So, yeah. I mean, I love when directors come, when I'm dried up or I'm blocked, please come with something. Somebody save my ass. I'm more than welcome. But let me allow me to do my thing first and then come and shape it, you know?
Yeah, you gotta run around the room a little bit. You gotta bump into some walls, and have the freedom to do so, as opposed to like, no, don't run into that wall. Like, let me run into the wall so I can figure it out and go from there. That's,
you know, really, and Spike Lee gave me that. Brian De Palma in Casualties, in Carlito's Way, gave me that. Brad Furman in The Take gave me all that space like that. And then Spike Lee in Summer of Sam. You know, we just had so much fun together.
Is there anything, you know, you've worked with so many legendary directors over your career, my friend. What is there anything you brought in into your own filmmaking, into your own producing, into your own writing that you've been able to bring in from some of these masters that you've worked with?
Absolutely, man. I had no idea, you know, that their influence would live with me for the rest of my life. Because I didn't know I was going to be a filmmaker. You know, I thought I was just going to be an actor or a writer. And then when I started directing, it was like, oh, wow, I have this Rolodex. That's how old I am. I use the word Rolodex. I have a Rolodex of all this information from Baz Luhrmann to Spike Lee to Tony Scott. You know, all their techniques and their problem solving is all in here in my computer. And I can have access to it. And when I did critical thinking, I was like, I had all these problems, had a tiny budget, had these great actors, but we had all these problems. We were shooting in the real hood, and they tried to, you know, put guns at us to get us out. You know, and people were being shot around the. It was like madness was happening. You know how it happens in every film. It's like that. But I had the solutions, and I had all these techniques, and it was great to have all that information in my head. from these masters.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Is there ever a day, I have to believe there is, as either a filmmaker or as an actor, that it was like kind of the whole world was coming crashing down around you? You thought, at least. And, you know, whatever that might be, whatever it was, that day was happening to you. How did you overcome those obstacles of that moment, of that day, whether acting or filmmaking?
I mean, Critical Thinking had that, but I got to say The Take with Brad Furman, that was his first film. And we became buds for life. You know, we're bros for the rest of our lives. I'm doing a movie with him right now called Tin Soldier with Bobby De Niro and Jamie Foxx and Clint Scott Eastwood. And my daughter, actually.
Nice.
But The Take, man, everything that could go wrong in an independent film went wrong on this movie. But it made us a force. You know, I stuck by my director, and then Rosie jumped in, and the three of us, we muscled and willed this movie into happening. And, you know, I protected the director because everything was going wrong. The first day we started shooting, the chef, because we were in the hood in Boyle Heights, and these gang members came up and they wanted to eat our craft service. And it's like, yo, we're in their hood. Let them eat the food. Who gives a fuck? It's like, how much does that chicken cost you? Let me buy that for you and give it to them. But anyway, they wanted the food. And he said no. And the kid grabbed it and he choked the chef, tried to choke the kid. Kid pulls out a gun. So now we got gunplay. The police come immediately, shut down our set. There are helicopters flying around. The director, and Brad was brilliant. He was like, film it. And that's our opening credits.
Because you got all that extra production value.
Amazing. Production value up the ass. That was day one. Day two, hair and makeup quit because they can't work in this dangerous set. And Rosie's like, I got Caribbean hair. I need somebody to do my hair. So, you know, her hair for the rest of the movie is like here and there, you know, because she's doing it herself.
Right.
That was day two.
I love the idea that you said that I protected my director, because on a film like that, it was his first feature, right?
Yeah.
So he was his first feature, and I'm sure there was money people and producers and everything.
Oh yeah.
They're looking for a reason to get rid of the director, especially if they're falling behind or shit's happening or things like that.
Yeah. They turn the director easily. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
But I'm old school, man. You know, I don't know where that comes from being growing up in the hood, and you're always taught to loyalty is the most important thing, or being a Latin person, your loyalty is everything, you know, that's all that we care about. So anyway, all that, you know, I'm going to take care of this kid. This kid has heart. He's got talent, and I'm not going to let nobody take him down. You know, so I just stuck by him, and I go, shoot, we're going to go. I'm going to the hood every day. I don't care. And we're going to guerrilla. You know, we stole shots in buses.
We
stole shots everywhere, you know. Because the third day, I got to tell you, the third day, the SAG comes in and takes away the kid who was playing my son. We shot 3 days with him. The third day, they said he had forged his A. It was an F, and he admitted it looked like an A, and they had to take him out. So we had to reshoot with a new kid. It was, dude, every day, 28 days of madness like that.
And we just kept going.
Yeah, just kept going.
It's amazing. And that so many filmmakers coming up don't understand the insanity of what it is to make an independent film and
you gotta love it. You end up loving it.
You love
the creative, and you're more creative because you're being pushed against the wall, and you have to solve these problems, and you have to get through your film, and you have to, and you want to get creative work. You don't want to just shoot something that's average.
So what I love about your career is that you've worked on indie films, obviously at like a really low budget world. And you've also worked on some of the biggest budget films and with the biggest directors.
Die Hard 2.
Yeah, I mean, with every resource at your disposal.
Right, right.
How does, let's say, a Baz Luhrmann on Moulin Rouge, which obviously was not an indie film. that was such a big
No. There's nothing like that, or nothing ever will be like that.
It's one of my favorite films of all.
Oh my God. It was a game changer.
Love
Moulin. I mean, 27 angles on certain scenes, bro. We would do 50 takes on certain stuff.
How many cameras was he shooting?
No, he had like three or four. So he would move them all around. So it was like, you know, hours and days on
one scene. So then he'd just be cutting.
Four here, then they move into the other section, then they incrementally, not like all the way to the other side, just incrementally moving it around up here, down. I mean, he got every angle, you know. The Moulin Rouge, I think, was very disconcerting for a lot of old school filmmakers and people, because it would move so fast and it was cutting. You know, the cutting was so quick and so it made people dizzy. But it was, for the rest of us who were young, we loved it. It was groundbreaking.
And the music, the way he was able to incorporate old music and new music. And
he was the first to do that, to use old music. And then it became like such an annoying trick that everybody's using now and too much, you know.
But so, all right. So when you're working with someone like Baz or like on Romeo and Juliet, Jesus, like what was it like reciting Shakespeare in that beautiful insanity that he had built for you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I love Shakespeare, but I don't love doing it.
I love it now
as I'm older. You know, I'm old. You know, like musicians are either classical or jazz. I was more of a jazz instrument. You know, that's what I fancied myself and what I liked. Mm-hmm. So I was moving towards that. But when I got into the Shakespeare, I was like, oh, I can groove with this. And we did a 2-week workshop. And, you know, I was Tybalt too much. I was getting into fights in the street and had my tongue broken by getting into fights. I mean, the character sometimes overtakes you and it makes you stupid. But it was amazing. I mean, he was so specific about his vision. You know, he had a vision. And you know, he told me he wanted me to be a flamenco dancer and a bullfighter. So I studied that and I took flamenco classes and all that to give him that way of moving. Cause you know, I'm much more street, and he wanted me to be, you know, very
elegant almost.
Yeah, haughty.
Yeah.
Yeah. That flamenco bullfighting thing. That's
uppity.
Yeah. Mad uppity.
But like, so working with someone like Baz, who had such a specific vision. I mean, I remember watching Romeo and Juliet when I went to the theaters to see it. And my first thought was like, how did this get financed? How did this get approved? How did this sneak through?
Not easy. Dates? Not easy. Like, I mean, Moulin Rouge was not easy. I saw what that brother had to struggle to get that money out of the studios. You know, it's not just Latin people and Black people who struggle to get films made. White folk struggle too, in a different way. I mean, but you know, he had to prove that Romeo and Juliet was viable. They don't want to do period stuff. They don't want to do Shakespeare. They don't want to do arty stuff. They don't think it has commercial value. Right. So he did a whole audition with Leo DiCaprio and locations, and he had lookbooks and he had the music. He had the whole vision, and he had to convince the studio to cough up the cash so he could shoot this film. Then he has this massive hit.
Huge.
And then he's got to convince them again that he can do a musical, because musicals, the last successful musical was Grease in 1972. And we're shooting now in 1999, 2000.
Wow.
He had to do it again. So he had to do, you know, visuals with Hugh McGregor and Nicole Kidman auditioning. And you know, it was wild, wild.
So that, I didn't think about that. You're right. There wasn't a musical since Grease before Moulin Rouge. And then after Moulin Rouge, then I remember
there been some, but they all failed. So it was like the musical was dead on film.
Right. But then after Moulin Rouge, then Chicago.
Then he opened it up. He proved that it could be successful. Right.
That's remarkable, man.
He's brilliant, man. You can't underestimate his genius. He's one of a kind. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I'm dying to see Elvis. I can't wait to see.
Oh yeah, I know. Everything he touches,
it's absolutely remarkable. Is there something, man, that you wish someone would have told you at the beginning of your career? To go back and you're like, man, you know, watch out for this.
Definitely, in terms of. I mean, I feel like I struggled with not the acting part. I mean, I didn't realize that the racism, that talent didn't trump racism. I really believed, I don't know, I was naive, oh, I don't know, a dreamer or whatever. You just believe you can change the world. But I didn't realize that there was a glass ceiling. I didn't understand that. I didn't really believe it. I didn't want to believe it. I think it would have disillusioned me. But there was a glass ceiling. You just were never going to get, you thought, oh, I did this role. I worked with these great directors.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Now I'm going to get those leads. I want to get those important leads that lead you to Oscars, that lead you to the same equal status as your white peers, you know, but they weren't. They weren't coming, and you vie for them, and they don't consider you because you're a Latin dude. Or yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on that I kept in denial. And the writing was the same way too. Like I had all these great scripts, and I would go around from studio, and they were like, "Oh, we love it." Well, and then they had no reason why they didn't want to do it. They just were never going to do a Latin project. Right. If I had written white scripts, boom, I would have been a famous screenwriter. But it was so difficult to get. It's still difficult to get Latin content out there. I mean, I hear the conversations that they're having. You know, they're okay with two Latin people, maybe three. But if it's like, do they want the lead? The two leads to be Latin, not so much the money folk. The money, the conversation is still like that.
Really? I think nowadays considering from the 80s and 90s, we're just miles different than we were then.
Yeah.
As far as that kind of just inclusion in general and other cultures.
But they're trying. They're definitely trying, but there's still like roadblocks and silent, you know, unspoken quotas. Definitely. I'm not going to lie. I'm being straight up with you.
I appreciate that. No, I appreciate that. And it's so fascinating because I always like asking, you know, actors of someone of your stature who's done so many things, has a name, people know who you are. You still have problems getting projects made. And I want people to understand.
Oh, absolutely,
like,
absolutely.
It's not like, oh, you're John Leguizamo. You could just, you know, just make a phone call and you can have $5 million and make your own movie.
No, like, I could. But I don't want to water down. I'm an artist. I see myself as an artist and as a pioneer.
Right.
And I don't want to water down my things. I don't want to have to whitewash everything I do.
I understand what you're saying. Right.
So
to maintain the integrity of your project.
Right. I mean, I could easily, you know, everything could be, you know, one Latin dude and one white dude, you know, like, you know, do the thing that they always want. They want always want to, it's a nepotistic business in terms of wanting white actors to be in your projects, because that's what they're still old school mentality, and they think that that's going to sell. But, you know, I mean, there was a time that Will Smith couldn't get an action film done. And then he proved to the world that, yeah, black people are box office gold internationally. You know, there was that whole conversation that in that era. Yep.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, like I remember. You're like, oh, it's African American. You can't put him in.
Sell internationally. Oscar Isaacs. Look at Oscar Isaac. If things were fair and non-racist, he'd be Oscar Isaac Hernandez. But he can't. He is still in this modern day. He has to go by Oscar Isaac, because if he had the Hernandez still on his resume, he may not get those roles, those leads, because that's what is going on. That's a sign of the times.
It's really fast.
And I'm being straight up with you. I mean, most people won't talk about these things because it's ugly and they don't want to talk about it. But I want these things to change.
Yeah, agreed. And that's why, you know, that's one of the reasons why I do the show, is I want to educate people about what the realities of this business are. And you can't look at life, you know, especially walking into this business with starry-eyed and like, I have a dream. Just because I watch movies, it's all beautiful. I watch the Oscars. It's like nice. But I always tell people, you want a great analogy for Hollywood? Look at Oscar night. Oscar night looks gorgeous. The night after the Oscars, I wouldn't go down to where the Oscars were at night.
Right.
Hollywood Boulevard, it ain't a pretty place, brother.
No, it's not.
You know, except for that one week, it looks great. But that's
true. It's true.
They sell the sizzle, but they don't sell the steak. They're not good at selling that steak, but they sell that sizzle great, though, don't they?
It's true. I mean, the people don't like to talk about what is really going on. I mean, and you know, you if you blow up what's going on, people aren't happy about it either, and they don't usually like that. And you become a little bit of a, you know, of a lightning rod.
So
people are careful.
Exactly. But you know what? Things are changing. And I think people
are moving.
They are moving forward. You know, there's things. Look, like I said before, like in 91, Robert Rodriguez was the first Latin director I'd ever seen in my life.
Right.
No, there were others, but he was the first one I saw. And I was like, oh, and he's 23. And oh, I think I could go out.
Well, you know, you thought that was going to blow the dam open. You thought, oh my God, now every Latin director has a chance. And it didn't happen, which is crazy. And then you got your Guillermo del Toro's and you got your
of course.
And it keeps course they have to like work, you know, white, but you know,
to a certain extent, yeah. But like I remember coming up as a commercial director, I was in Miami and I couldn't do Latino spots and put them on my reel for the Spanish market. Right.
Absolutely.
Because if I did that, then I would be pigeonholed as a Spanish director. I couldn't then do general market.
Right. I was told when I begin, don't change your name. You can almost pass for Italian. If they don't know, then you'll be okay. Stay out of the sun. You know, all these things, you know, work on your accent and stuff like that. And, you know,
It's insane. But look, things are changing. Hopefully they'll continue to go down that path without question. Now, let's talk about your new project. The Green Veil, man. I absolutely love what you're doing with it, the idea about it. Can you tell everybody what it's about?
Yeah, well, this is another pioneering young director that I'm backing, that I believe in. I think he's a great, great new talent. And he's trying this new thing. It's never been done before. It's usually what you do with independent films. You do a negative pickup. And this is kind of like that old school system of, you know, you shoot your film because you believe in it. And you want it to have artistic integrity. Then you sell it, you know, at a film festival. So we did this with a TV series, 6 episodes. And so we shot that first, raised the money, shot it. And now we got into the Tribeca Film Festival, which is incredible that they gave us this space because they love the project. And it's about in the 1950s and before that, the government and the FBI and oil companies wanted Native American land. And they started in the late 1800s or the 1900s was taking their kids away from them. So if they took away their culture and their identity, they wouldn't go back to the reservation and they could take the land from there because they wouldn't inherit it. So, and then in the 50s, 60s and 70s, they started taking the children from them with excuses and giving them up for adoption so they could end the reservation, take the land and get the oil. So this takes place in 1950, and I play an FBI guy, a self-hating, you know, Latin guy who's taking these Native kids from their homes and putting them up for adoption. It's a true story based on true events.
When I was watching it, I was like, I've heard this story. I saw the 60 Minutes story about it. They did a whole bit. They did a 60 Minutes story about it.
Powerful.
It was so insane that they literally just kidnapped kids. Basically. And kind of put them in like these brainwashing scenarios, like just trying to strip the culture out of them. And then the abuse that happened and all
the deaths,
they were killed. They were dying and they were being treated inhumanely.
But it was to get the land. It was to get the land.
I didn't know about the land part. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the reason was, it wasn't, it wasn't like, we want to help them. No, it was to take their land because if they weren't tied to the land, they would move to cities. They would move away and they were moving them away into white families that would adopt them that weren't, you know, nearby.
Now, has this gotten bought yet, or are you now hoping?
No. The first day is coming up. June, I think it's June 15th. It's the first
screening of it.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. And then hopefully you're looking for someone to come in and
do a negative HBO or Showtime,
Netflix or someone like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Never been done before. So this is. Hopefully this is a new thing that can be done, you know, like
because
sort of the new independent film would be like a 4-part or 6-part series.
I mean, I think in generally on the business side of things, there's more value in a series than there is in a film.
Nowadays,
right. And correct, not artistically, I'm talking business wise, because I, you know, in the distribution world, like you got more content, it's bigger, it's a bigger
people
thing.
want a 4-5-night experience. Yeah, 6-night experience.
They want the Queen's Gambit.
That quick. Yeah.
They want the Queen's Gambit. It's like they want that kind of mini series or a series that can continue. But no, when I saw what it was about, I was like, man, God bless John for getting this out there, man, because it's a story that it's just in the mainstream wouldn't come out. It just wouldn't.
No. Exactly.
It wouldn't be
a passion project. Yeah. And, you know, and we have the approval of a Native American nation. We have a few Native American actors in it as well, you know, to representing themselves.
Sure.
In lead roles. Yep.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions that I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, I mean, definitely go to the great schools, you know. Mm-hmm. You got that's the best place to try. And you know, try to shoot as much as you can, you know, and work with everybody and work with all your friends and create a community. I think I saw that. We all saw that with Spielberg and Coppola.
Smarty, all of that.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. They all hung together. They read each other's scripts. They helped each other. And then Guillermo del Toro, Iñárritu, and Alfonso Cuarón had a company, and they were producing Latin content. They were helping each other out. I mean, that's the thing, is create a community. Don't make other directors your enemy. Make them your brothers and your sisters, and create those communities that you help each other. And you make each other's scripts better, and you make each other's projects better, and you help them make their projects. That's, you help each other. You piggyback and you create better and more content.
I just always love that story of when George Lucas played Star Wars for that gang. Of all,
yeah,
and everyone's like, I'm sorry, George, this sucks.
That's not gonna work.
It's not gonna work, man, at all. And the only one was Steven Spielberg. He was like, you got something here, I think. Yeah.
But you got De Palma and Coppola.
Coppola, it's Scorsese.
This is a different school of filmmaking.
Milius, for God's sakes. Yeah. I mean, oh, God, can you imagine? What is the biggest lesson you learned from your biggest failure?
That you can't plan for that shit. You can't,
right?
You can't go around your whole life full of fear and going, oh, I got to make the right choice. No, I think you have to take risks, and you got to live. You got to go with your gut, even if it fails. You got, and the failures, they may hurt you a little bit, but you got to keep going, and don't let the failures define you. You know, that's what I learned from that. I'm not going to let, you know, luckily I grew up in a tough neighborhood. And I knew the business was never for me. So I never really embraced it. So I don't really accept their opinion of me. You know what I mean? So I just keep going and do my thing. Now, I'm not going to let them define me in any kind of way, because they've always tried to define me in the negative.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh, shit. That's a good question. Well, that, you know, that writing takes a lot of rewriting. That's the biggest lesson. That writing is just crazy amounts of rewriting, and you better love your rewriting, because that's it better be joyful, because it's going to be everything. You're going to spend all your hours, because I'm a writer.
Right. Now, and three of your favorite films of all time.
No, I mean, Godfather, of course, Annie Hall. And Raging Bull, I guess those are my favorite three films.
That's a good trio, my friend. That's a good trio. Brother, man, you obviously have so much passion for what you do. You could just, it just falls off the screen as I'm talking to you. And after all the years you've been doing this, man, you still are so passionate about your projects. You're still so passionate about what you're doing and about helping people, about opening doors, about creating opportunities for people, man. I got to thank you, man, for doing that and continuing to do it and being a champion for not only Latino filmmakers, but for artists, man, and getting things out there. That
I love my artists, man. Yeah, I love all.
And
artists.
I love that you're just like, you are a risk taker. You have been since the beginning of when you were first on Miami Vice, man. Back in the day.
19, looking like such a punk. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? But everybody went through Miami Vice, brother. Everybody.
Everybody did. I was like every Latin person that. They gave us work. It was the time that all Latin people, every actor you ever met that was Latin was working.
Absolutely, because it was all going to Miami Vice. I had Eddie almost on a while ago, and he would tell me stories, dude. Oh my God, the stories of him and Don Johnson battling it out, and his wow. method, and he like owned his character. So like, he just told everybody what to do about his character, and like everybody was pissed off about it. But anytime they had a problem, they call Michael Mann up, and Michael Mann's like. It's Eddie. Let him do whatever he wants to do.
Oh, wow. How beautiful is that?
That's amazing. It was like, I was like, how did you get that, Eddie? He's like, I just asked for it at the beginning of my career and I never let go of it. And I'm like,
Amazing. He's such a great spirit, too.
I love that dude. So listen, brother, thank you again, man, for everything you do. Congrats on your new project. And I hope it sells, man. I hope this is the beginning of a new thing.
I know. We'll know soon. It's coming up.
I appreciate you, brother. Thanks again, man.
Thank you for having me, man. Pleasure.
I want to thank John so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with the tribe today. Thank you so, so much. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/209. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. If you love the show, guys, please share it, talk about it, share it with all your friends. I want this information to get out there as much as possible on YouTube, on the podcast, on Apple, on Spotify, wherever you watch or listen to this. Please share it with as many people as possible. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing. No matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.